everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, what is the United States' real agenda in the Middle East, and why is the United States and its allies supporting radical Islamic terrorist organizations to orchestrate regime change in the region? My guest from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, is Mahdi Darius Nazimirazi. He is an award-winning author, a scholar, geopolitical analyst, specializing in the Middle East and Central Asia. He is a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. He's a contributor at the Strategic Cultural Foundation in Moscow and the Voltaire Net, and is a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. And during the Arab Spring, Mahdi reported from North Africa, particularly in Libya, during the NATO bombing, providing dispatches to Global Research and Pacificus program Flashpoint. More recently, his focus has been on the upheavals in Syria and Iraq and the role of the United States in the Middle East and its instability. He is the author of Globalization of NATO, which has been hailed by multilateral leaders and foreign government ministers as a tour de force on the expansion of NATO and its threat to peace and global security. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Knoll.
I have a question for you, Mahdi. I think that a lot of people who are concerned about this are facing now. On the one hand, we're told that we have to go after the Islamic State because they represent a threat to the United States as well as to the region, and they're going to take over Iraq if we didn't intervene. Okay, that may or may not be true, to some degree, now or in the future. But why are we not talking about how they evolved? Why are we not looking at Libya? Why are we not looking at what we did to Gaddafi? Did Gaddafi actually represent a threat so great that that the President of the United States and our allies, including France and Great Britain, joined together to destroy Gaddafi in Libya? Did we get a better Libya afterwards? Is it a democratic Libya? Are the people free? Is it prosperous? Are people doing well? Or is there another story that once we convinced the world public that we should go to Libya and destroy Libya, that suddenly we saw people from the Sudan by the truckloads, terrorists? We saw people from Somalia, terrorists. We saw Al-Qaeda. We saw people that had never been in any number more than a few percent in Libya, and then look at the country today. Could you take us on that journey to show us the evolution of these terrorist groups and how we have participated in training them along with our allies, like Turkey trains terrorists, Saudi Arabia funds and trains terrorists. At the same time, they're saying that they want to be a part of the coalition that destroys the Islamic State. They've also been training all the radical groups. And the same is also true for Jordan. So why can't we ever be honest about where these people come from and how we participated in that? But could you please start with Libya to give us a little history of the association between Libya, Syria, and the terrorist groups who are now in Syria and in Iraq?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's one that the American people have to ask their representatives and elected officials, the ones who purport to represent democracy and freedom. The answer to this, actually, the Russian foreign minister at the high-level meeting of the United Nations Security Council, Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, as well as the Chinese foreign minister.
This is a good connection.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. The Russian foreign minister, the Chinese foreign minister, and the president of Argentina ask these questions of the United States and Security Council. Both Russia and China have asked for a UN forum to be formed to answer those questions. And the reason is, they already know who's helped form these groups, which parties. It's the same parties that are purporting to fight terrorism. And since I said this converging starts this, I'll begin with the United States has used groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in places like Egypt during the time of Gamal Abdel Nasser for trying to push regime change. The British, the same thing. But then there's also the 1980s, where the United States said, U.S. strategists said, well, we can use deviant elements amongst Muslims. We can nurture them, and we can use them against the Soviet Union, against Moscow, you had the Mujahideen being created in Afghanistan. It's a policy that Seymour Hersh in 2006-2007 called the redirection. Why it was called the redirection? It was to use the same direction that in the Brzezinski area was being used against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So this is why you have these groups being supported in places like Libya. Mr. Obama also, when he was elected, and before he actually became president, while he was president-elect, was actually reaching out to groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. His campaign team actually was helping them with their media work, and that's why he had that meeting in Cairo for a new beginning, as they call it. At the same time, the U.S. government, several institutes, Madeleine Albright was part of them, were reaching out to the Turks to help them in this endeavor and promising the Turks to become the leaders of the Muslim world. That's where the term neo-Ottomanism comes from. And that's why you see these groups in Libya, which the United States has supported for a long time, the Libyan Islamic fighting groups against Gaddafi. Gaddafi was fighting these groups coming to power. So we have the strategy against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. You have the strategy against Libya. And you also have plans of basically making Muslims fight each other, the Shiites and Sunnis, all converging together. There was protests in Syria in 2011 for democracy, but there was also people who were attacking the protesters and the government forces and instigating for fighting on both sides. In fact, from the very beginning, there was people cutting heads. And I want to say something. These extremist elements or these deviant elements that are being supported in the Middle East and North Africa, they're not necessarily Islamists. They're extremists. Terrorists are terrorists no matter what. And the United States is now trying to give the spin that, oh, we're fighting ISIL, al-Nusra, but we're going to help the moderates. These are terrorists. Whatever you want to call them, moderate terrorists or not, moderate death squads or not, they're still death squads and still terrorists. And people shouldn't fall for that spin. U.S. allies that are part of this coalition, like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, on the record have said they support the al-Nusra Front. Okay, so this is something on the record that's not hidden. American allies in Lebanon, like Walid al-Jumblat of the Progressive Socialist Party, the Druze chieftain, their warlord, actually, he's on the record of saying, I am al-Nusra. Al-Qaeda flags have been flying in Lebanon for almost a decade. You can see them in Beirut. You can see them in the areas where the Western-supported politicians are, and it's never been mentioned once, where people openly say they're Bin Ladenites, supporters of Osama Bin Laden. So you can see that in Tripoli or in parts of Beirut or in Sidon. So this strategy of supporting terrorism has been a U.S. tool for a long time. It starts in the Cold War. The United States has imposed regime change on Syria twice already through Beirut during the Cold War. The Baghdad Pact was also created on the sidelines of this to help that strategy, where terrorism was being used at the same time with regime change initiatives through military force. And speaking of Libya, let me be very categorical about what I say. The plans for regime change in Libya were made and reviewed by the United States Security Council. They were started during the Reagan administration, and they were only refurbished and put into operation during the Obama era. But I want to point out that Robert Gates, the person who was behind those plans, or reviewed them, actually. Robert Gates, while he was working for the Security Council, was asked to review them. There was two sections to the plan. One was to support opposition groups and militias. The other was for military action. And it was put into execution under Robert Gates' assignment to the Department of Defense as a Pentagon chief or the U.S. Secretary of Defense. These are long-standing plans and long-standing support for terrorism. So there is no moderates, there is no extremists, they're all terrorists. So they can call one group Islamic terrorists, whatever they like to call them, and the others moderates. But at the end of the day, they're still murdering people. They're still terrorists.
Mahdi, how do you rationalize or how do you explain that Saudi Arabia has been beheading hundreds of people per year for decades, sometimes for something as simple as witchcraft, which doesn't exist, but someone who is doing something that they don't like, nothing that we would consider a crime in the United States, and yet we do not ever say a thing against Saudi Arabia, even though it does not allow women to drive, women to have any power. They cannot be seen, let's say, traveling without a immediate family member. They have strict dress codes if they're on the street. And they dress in anything that reveals even an ankle, that there is a code police that will stop them and find them or even arrest them. You have Saudis who support one of the most radical forms of Islam, Wahhabism, and that is never discussed. We know for a fact that the major planners of the 9/11 crisis were from Saudi Arabia, and yet the Saudis were allowed out of the United States. No other group in the world was allowed out, but they were. They had their own plane. They got them all out. And the redacted pages in the 9/11 report, according to legislators who saw it, involved the Saudis. And so Saudi Arabia is given a clean bill of health without any of the honest revelation of that it is a terrorist nation and always has been. Your thoughts on that, please.
Okay, well, I want to tweak things and say the House of Saud is a supporter of terrorism. Most of the Saudi peoples are actually occupied people. Most of the people in that Arabian Peninsula under the territory we call Saudi Arabia, they're occupied. They want that regime to fall. They don't want to be, a lot of them don't want to be a part of it. They see them as traitors and U.S. proxies. Saudi Arabia is the arm of the United States. And this is what it comes down to. You'd ask me to rationalize what's burning people and chopping heads. I can't rationalize it. What I can do is say that there's certain people in the U.S. government who should be asked to give their justifications for this, which they won't. They'll make some sort of story up. They support them, and they're not against it because at the end of the day, those things don't matter. It's the interests of oligarchs and elites that matter, disguised under some veneer of democracy in the United States. But of course they don't care about the head chopping. Let me give you an example. The United States and other leaders from the so-called West didn't go to the Sochi Olympics. Their leaders didn't go. They said they're boycotting it because of a gay rights issue in Russia. All right. Well, I can accept your words about what you said. Those are your statements. But at the same time, the same people who said they won't go to Sochi because of the gay rights situation in Russia went to Saudi Arabia, where it's illegal to be gay, where you'll be executed. Okay, so this is clear double standards, regardless of where you stand on these issues, regardless of if you believe the United States supports democracy or not. It clearly has double standards. You know, for example, people in Bahrain, one of the most oppressive countries in the Middle East, try to stand up for some basic elementary rights like voting, being able to participate, being even considered citizens of their own state. They're killed with tanks, you know, and the United States does nothing. But then when in Libya the flags of democracy and freedom are raised, you know, the United States quickly jumps on this boat. And then we see the people it supports. They're not people who want democracy. In fact, the United States has helped crush democracy in the Middle East by helping maintain most of these regimes in place for decades. The United States, Britain, France, because they maintained some sort of colonial order in that area.
Share with us any more recent information and clear evidence of the United States' support of these militant factions that have morphed into the Islamic State, even though President Obama is now stating he is intending to rid the world of them. Do you interpret this as being the case the state has already served its purpose, or that for various reasons it got out of hand and out of the U.S.'s control? Those are just projections. I'm interested in your perspective. And lastly, major media reports on ISIS or the Islamic State now threatening attacks on American soil and against American citizens. On the other hand, this enables Washington to increase its domestic surveillance at a time when it's under a great deal of pressure and criticism for that domestic and intelligence gathering. Do you feel there's any credible evidence behind the Islamic State threats, or is this another U.S. smokescreen or psyops for, again, instilling fear in the population, keeping the war on terror alive?
Okay, well, the United States, when it bombed Syria, when it started to bomb Syria, just before the U.S. Secretary of State, Mr. John Kerry, who's been prancing around capitals around the world lying consistently, said, him as well as Pentagon officials said, there was an imminent threat to U.S. soil, okay? And they were. This was their way of trying to get legal cover by invoking Article 51 of the U.S. Charter, United Nations Charter for self-defense. Any nation in the United Nations, any member state is allowed to self-defense to attack another country if there's proof of a imminent attack, okay? But this wasn't a state we're dealing with, number one. Number two, there has to be proof, and they haven't provided the proof. Instead, they said there's a new organization called Khorasan. Khorasan is an old name for the eastern part of Iran and Afghanistan, basically. But anyway, this new group. My point here is very simple. They said there's an imminent threat of attack to U.S. soil. That means there's cells in the United States. These cells, as the United States has taught us all, as U.S. experts consistently tell us, work on their own, and they're not. There's no command and control. I mean, if it's a cell in the United States and you just bomb Syria, don't you think that they can act on their own? So there was no imminent threat. I think that that's a lie. The other thing is that the country that's been fighting these people the most, Syria, number one, says the United States is one of their supporters. Number two, an American ally. Members of the government of Iraq, including the deputy prime minister, have said the United States is the one that supports the IS. And same thing with the Russians and the Iranians. I mean, we have these are countries. Some have friendly relations with the United States. Some don't. And at times there's a roller coaster on how the relationship's a roller coaster. But they've all essentially said the United States has double standards. That it, when they say double standards, what do they mean? They mean that it supports terrorism, and now it's pretending to fight terrorism. So we shouldn't be fooled. I mean, I believe Iranian military commanders when they say that this is a joke, this coalition against the ISIL, because it's all the people who helped create it, and we're not going to join it at all.
For many reasons, including representing a different division of Islam, Iran remains the odd nation out. It has a vital history, an enormous army, a highly learned professional class, more resources than any other nation in the Middle East or the Gulf. And how do you foresee the destabilization and division of the surrounding Arab nations serving an offense against Iran? Would you be able to attempt to map out the steps that you foresee trying to be achieved to remove the government in Iran? And tell us a little bit about the terrorist organization, the MEK, that the U.S. and its allies are now supporting to overthrow Tehran. And my final question on Tehran is this. We know that on numerous occasions, Israel was ready to attack Iran, and it is postured. And I believe that had Russia not intervened, it would have given the Israelis an opportunity about the last 9 months ago, a year ago. Here's my question then. Let's just say at some point, based upon the revving up of the war on terror, that Israel makes a preemptive strike against Iran. What is the likely outcome? Clearly, Iran expects and is prepared for, anticipated, and has strategies for being attacked first. The Israelis would not go in and do a small attack. They would want to take out every military installation, intelligence installation. They have outstanding intelligence with the Mossad in Israel, so the likelihood is that the top leaders would be assassinated at the same time. There'd be a civil uprising. They would probably have that in motion with cells working there. But then that also means that you will not be able to take out all of those in power. You would still have a very formidable fighting force, well-armed, and capable of engaging in guerrilla warfare. In effect, to me, it would be like the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese, and Israel would have the planes, it would have the personnel, the munitions, but they couldn't even destroy Hezbollah when they invaded Lebanon. They had to finally withdraw. With all the power they had, they couldn't destroy them in a tiny little area. We're talking about less than 100 miles. Could you imagine a country that's more than 2.5 times the size of Iraq and has the capacity to fight back? And I would see Iran engaging in immediate attacks against Saudi Arabia because they know that Saudi Arabia would have a hand in it, in Jordan, and also mining the straits to keep oil tankers from getting out, or blowing up some oil tankers, causing the cost of oil to skyrocket. Speculators would be all over that. A barrel of oil could easily go for $200 to $300 a barrel. You would then cause Russia and China to align themselves politically and supporting not direct military intervention, but certainly with satellites, intelligence, and resupply of weapons, munitions, Iran. And then that would cause a larger conflict, ideological conflict, which could cause Russia and China to join together to force the challenge in at least half of the world of no longer using the dollar as a reserve currency, which could cause our currency to implode, causing the cost of everything to drop, at least the value of what you're buying to drop, and the cost of buying anything to increase, this kind of paradox. And it would just totally hurt the United States and its economy. I don't see any of this being discussed. All I hear on the neocon programs like Fox or Mark Levin, these other people, is, you know, Israel's the champion of democracy. It's the only free country in the Middle East. It's our only real ally. And if it, you know, goes in and takes out Iran, good. It's the best thing that could happen. I don't believe they understand at all the consequences. Could you take the remaining time you have, please, and explain this phenomena? Because Iran, if they were allowed to go in, they alone, with all that they know and all that they have, they could destroy ISIS. They could destroy ISIS relatively easily. But the United States doesn't want that, because then it would give them a closer alliance with Iraq. And you don't want an Iraq-Iran alliance. We don't want that. We've tried to keep that from happening. Take us through this part of the story, please.
Okay, well, I'm going to start in reverse order, and I'm going to start with an Israeli attack potential.
Please speak up to the telephone.
I'm going to start by talking about the hypothetical Israeli attack on Iran. This is, of course, hypothetical, and what I'm saying is based in hypothetical terms. If ever that should happen, I think that the Iranians would respond immediately and drastically against the Israelis and the United States. I think that it wouldn't just be Israel that the Iranians would attack. They would attack the United States, because they've said it very clearly that if they are attacked by Israel, they will only see it as something that Israel can do with a U.S. green light. So the United States is also going to be attacked by the Iranians. So it won't be a war between Israel and Iran, or it'll include the United States. I also want to say that Russian and especially Chinese officials have also, and this includes military, high-ranking military officers, have made it very clear that they will respond, and those responses won't be political. And they do have their red lines, because the Russians have made it clear that anything that happens to Iran, there's regime change, for example, is a threat to the national security of Russia and is of high importance to Russia's national security. If the Iranians, let's say hypothetically, Tehran became a U.S. satellite, it would endanger Russia's southern belly. It would also endanger Russia's position in the Caucasus, the Caspian, Central Asia, and they cannot accept that on any terms whatsoever. The Chinese have also said, we won't hesitate. In fact, one of their rear admiral in China has gone on the record to say, yes, we would go to war with the Iranians. In fact, the Chinese just recently sent two warships in the Persian Gulf to do joint exercise with the Iranians. So there's interoperability between both sides. And you brought up an important point, which is the Iranians have been working on asymmetrical warfare. Of course, the United States is much stronger than Iran. It's the primal military power in the world, but it couldn't beat the Vietnamese resistance in Vietnam, and it won't be able to beat the Iranians in asymmetrical warfare. And in fact, Pentagon war games have shown that if there's a war between Iran and the United States, the U.S. fleet in the Persian Gulf will be sunk. They made it very clear before they invaded Iraq because they were thinking of invading Iran. All the war simulations showed that the ships would be sunk. The Iranians have inexpensive missiles that can just sink American aircraft carriers, sink the aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. In a defensive war that's of a guerrilla or asymmetrical nature, things are much different, and you will see broader intervention. If there's a war everywhere, the area from North Africa, from Eastern Europe all the way to the Chinese border is going to be turned into a front. Places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, they'll all explode. Cyprus, you'll see the front go there. Iranians also are one of the countries that produce the most ballistic missiles. They're one of the top, according to the latest I've read, one of the top 10 countries in ballistic missile manufacturing. And those ballistic missiles can reach Israel. They can each reach U.S. bases in Eastern Europe, and they can reach U.S. bases in the Gulf. Those bases will be fired upon in the situation of war. Now, in regards to the MEK, which Saddam Hussein supported against the Iranians, it's an anti-Iranian government militia, basically. Yeah, the United States State Department put it on the terrorist list because of its terrorist activities. And the Iranians consider it a terrorist organization. And the United States, actually, there was a fight when Iraq was invaded. The U.S., first of all, used the MEK as an excuse to say Saddam Hussein is a sponsor of terrorism, so it justified invading Iraq on the basis of that. But once it did, it basically started integrating the MEK into U.S. assets. So, and there was a fight between the State Department and the Pentagon on whether to mobilize the MEK in an invasion of Iran. They have troops trained. They had armored vehicles and firearms. And in Camp Ashraf, they took over it. And the United States basically has integrated the MEK into the Pentagon and CIA toolbox against Iran. And right now they're being groomed again. They're being groomed for pressure on Iran. Now this pressure could be for future regime change, which I wouldn't rule out, an attempt at it, or to pressure Iran in the nuclear negotiations. It's very important to know that the United States is also what it's doing right now. It's tied to its negotiations. Again, I have to point out in Europe, the United States and the European Union are negotiating a major free trade agreement, which is supposed to be sealed and signed next year. And the United States is now using this Russia threat and sanctions to basically maximize the concessions it gets from the European Union and to force them to buy American liquefied gas, which is much more expensive than Russian natural gas. And at the same time, it's using this remobilization in Iraq and support for the MEK that it's giving, which is being funded by the United States. And people like Rudy Giuliani, Newt Gingrich, Joseph Lieberman, Senator McCain are basically lobbying for the MEK. And they're being funded $10,000. Each one of these people speaks at an MEK event gets paid. Anyways, they're using this for pressure on Iran in the nuclear negotiations to get some sort of concession. And those negotiations are supposed to be finalized next month, towards the end of next month. I don't know if they'll succeed. I've talked to people who are pessimistic. We'll have to see what happens. And the final question you had, I can't remember the first, actually it was the first question. I don't remember it.
Well, we're out of time. I just want to say that you're one of the very few people that has challenged the United States, Britain, Israel for being responsible for the suffering and deaths of so many people, the injuring of unaccountable more, the migration and exile of millions. And yet, we seem to be looking at a nihilistic, moral, and spiritual vacuum regarding our actions, as if there's no karma in the world. Your globalization of NATO has focused a lot of attention with your scholarship on that. And just I want to thank you for all your good work on these issues, because they give us a perspective that none of the media is sharing with us. And I thank you for doing that.
Thank you for having me.
From on Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, my guest, Professor Mahdi Darius Nazimi-Rojas. We appreciate his input. Our program that we just completed with him, the U.S.'s real agenda in the Middle East, and why we have been allied with some radical Islamic groups, as he said, they're all terrorists. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Let's go over and say hello now to my guest who's standing by, Tom Englehart. Tom's in New York. Tom is one of the nation's foremost commentators on the U.S. military, national security, and intelligence adventures and their impact upon American culture and economy. He is the founder of the Nation Institute's progressive blog, Tom's Dispatch. He is the author of Shadow Government, Surveillance, Secret Wars, and a Global Security State in a Single Superpower World, which examines how the U.S. has turned into a global security empire to fight secret wars to advance U.S. military interests. His website is tomdispatch.com. We're going to talk about U.S. imperialism through its expansion of a global security state. Nice to have you with us today, Tom.
Gary, good to talk to you.
One question that disturbs many thoughtful people is, how could the U.S. Look at the new resurgence of Islamic terrorist organizations, such as the recent ISIS or Islamic State, grow so rapidly, become so influential throughout the Muslim world, and yet not have been checked by our intelligence agencies long in advance. And if intelligence agencies are so astute, how could they have missed it so dismally? And there has been a great deal of criticism targeted against our national security state, the overkill of data collection, the redundancy and waste across 16 or 17 intelligence agencies, and of course the lies from the National Security Agency about how successful their surveillance efforts have been to prevent terrorist attacks in the United States. And as you have noted in your recent article on Tom Dispatch, we are spending about $68 billion a year for a system that is basically incompetent in fulfilling its mission. And I find it difficult to believe that our national leaders behind the National Security Agency's efforts are unaware of the problem, which in my mind raises the question whether or not our national security failures are intentional or might serve other purposes to simply expand surveillance across the world rather than to protect citizens from terrorism. So please begin by sharing a little bit about the reasons why the National Security Agency and its affiliate agencies have become an in-depth giant, and how do you see it serving the U.S. government's greater mission to become the world's single superpower that will dictate its demands unchallenged upon other nations? The forum is yours.
Yes, but you've asked a really tough question. I think it is true. If you go back to 9/11, If you start with 9/11 and you realize that that massive failure, which by the way resulted in no significant figures took any were accountable in any way, nobody got fired. Most of them actually got promoted along the lines. People like George Tenet and so on and so forth with the CIA. You see that failure in it, I mean the 9/11 disaster created the greatest explosion of the building of an intelligence network, in this case a global intelligence network, that we've ever seen on the planet. I mean, back in the 20th century, totalitarian regimes, you know, the USSR and so on, were capable really of monitoring their citizens pretty closely. But, of course, the technology wasn't there for the planet. And you're quite right in what you said. In the post 9/11 period, I mean, the U.S. intelligence community, as it likes to call itself, those 17 interlocked agencies, but particularly the NSA, or at least that's the one we know most about because Edward Snowden came forward, they have created a mind-boggling system that really is, in some sense, omniscient. That is, if you think of a godlike, you know, an eye in the sky, they really are capable of gobbling up almost anything on the planet. Any bit of communication, I mean, I'm always struck, people mostly know that, for instance, the German chancellor was, the NSA listened in on the German chancellor, bugged her cell phone. But what people don't realize is that what it actually did was to, in essence, start listening in on the phones of scores of young German politicians. She was just the one who rose to success, and we were already bugging her. But this system, from German politicians to the Brazilian president to, you know, people in the backlands of Pakistan or Iran or wherever, it is at one level mind-boggling. It is as close to omniscient as you can imagine a system getting at this point on this planet. On the other hand, as you also point out, it's omniscient without in any way seemingly being omnipotent, in the sense that, you know, American actions in the world since 9/11 have really, I mean, which are mostly military actions of one sort or another, have resulted in one obvious disaster after another, and the inability to do anything, I mean, as we see in Iraq today, the inability to do anything but repeat our mistakes over and over again. And in this sense, you know, on the recent, particularly on ISIS, we know that, you know, I mean, that we had leaders who were completely surprised by the rise of ISIS. Now, when you're within such a big system, 17 agencies, $68 billion, and so on and so forth, you're bound to have smart people who actually offer reasonable analysis. But it's clear that what finally made it up to the top, as always, was, you know, behind the eight ball, three steps behind. They were not ready for it. You know, the irony is that if our intelligence network, this huge, intersprawling, interlocked, overlapping thing, were a domestic thing, and we're dealing with, I don't know, you know, health or welfare or anything else, the Republicans would have gone after it years ago with a meat cleaver. You know, they would have axed 15 of the agencies and or tried to and downsized the other two. And in the case of the intelligence community, that wouldn't be a crazy thing. So I think you're quite right in what you said. It is a system. It's an omniscient system that somehow doesn't function very well. But that not functioning well, the success of failures, actually simply bolster the system. That is, the minute something doesn't work, more money goes into it, and you get a larger system. I'm not convinced that this means that a bunch of people are sitting around thinking, how can we fail tomorrow? I don't think they're actually that sharp. So I don't think that. I actually think this is the system they've set up. It really does fail, but it kind of works. Failure works. It's a kind of success. But I don't think it's literally conspiratorial in that sense.
Okay. Well, we've seen in corporate America failing up. Constantly people whose corporations went bankrupt, they yes. got the last laugh. They got yes. out with millions, and some other corporation hired them right away. And
exactly.
So we have this. Tom, back in the mid-1990s, Peter Dale Scott had identified and defined what he called deep politics, which led to his identifying a deep state in the United States, a government working within the government that was not obligated to the laws of the nation. And since then, the United States intelligence agencies have expanded exceedingly with a high-tech surveillance, spying, and data collection and mining. And this is part of what you call a shadow government.
Yeah.
So speak further on the structure of this secret government and how the Orwellian terms it is intended to shatter individual privacy and liberty and what remains of our constitutional freedoms.
Yes. You know, by the way, the first people to write about this were actually two American journalists who wrote a book back in 64, which was called The Invisible Government. And it was a shocker at the time because they said just what you've said, but this was back in 1964. There's a government Americans largely don't know about within the American government that is not even responsible to the president, that can't be brought to account, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's a long history of this, but it's obviously been strengthened, exaggerated in the post 9/11 period, because what you see in the first thing is, I think what you can say about Washington generally is that Washington post 9/11 entered what I would call its post legal phase. That is, if you break into a house, Gary, you probably, and you're caught, you'll be brought to court. If the government breaks into a house or tortures somebody or kidnaps people off global streets or whatever, I mean, you can go through a vast list of these things, nobody will be brought to account. I mean, you know now, if you're in the American government, in that shadow government, you know that nothing you do will ever be brought to account, no matter how heinous. There's no crime, you know, lying to Congress, killing prisoners in secret prisons around the world, in the Bush era. I mean, there are all sorts of things like this that were done that cannot. So that's the first thing. If you're in that government, you basically can no longer be brought to account. And I thought one of the more interesting exchanges recently was between the CIA and Dianne Feinstein, because Dianne Feinstein has often been called the senator of the national security state. She's always promoted the national security state. And the one time she, in essence, turned on it and criticized the CIA over its torture report, they went after her. I mean, they hacked into her committee's computers. They did a whole series of things that, I mean, you really could have been brought to trial for, but they weren't, obviously. So that's one thing. Non-accountability, the shadow government is ever less accountable. The shadow government is ever more secret. You know, I mean, we know this. That a number of secrecy. I mean, Obama came in as the supposed sunshine president, and in his years, secrecy has descended even more cloakingly on the U.S. government. I think the last figures I've seen on classified documents, the government generated 92 million in, I think, 2011. I'm not sitting in front of my computer where I can look at the figures, but I think that's accurate. About 92 million documents that were classified. It's staggering. The numbers on all this are startling. And, of course, along with this has gone an incredible punitiveness, as we've never seen before, towards anybody who wants to tell the American people what's going on inside their government. I mean, theoretically, the government is the government of the American people, but it's now believed by this, I would call them kind of a warrior religious class, I mean, who are in the shadow government. It's they now believe that it's for the American people's own good that they not know anything, and they shouldn't know anything. It's a rather striking set of things: secrecy, non-accountability, punitiveness of an incredible and implacable sort toward anyone who says anything about what's going on inside the government. It's brought that structure that you were talking about to kind of a new stage in these years.
Tom, going back to the Bush administration, the U.S. has steadily removed itself from international laws that bind it to civil and human rights, torture, the means by which it instigates wars and the numbers killed, the increasing exclusion of itself from being bound by any laws anywhere in the world, including war crimes. And Obama has only continued this direction and turned the U.S. into the world's largest rogue nation. Clearly, if a country could be placed on a shrink's couch and psychoanalyzed, the U.S. would likely be diagnosed as sociopathic with no remorse whatsoever for the huge numbers of innocent people it murders to proceed with this global agenda. And yet it's this very national illness that is enabled the U.S. to move towards global superpower status. So when we speak of the U.S. turning from a national security state to a global security state, immune to international laws, what is the rest of the world actually facing in the future? What kind of world do we see this leading towards if it remains unchecked?
Well, actually, I don't really see it leading toward. I mean, I think the world is a very odd place right now. I mean, to go back at least several centuries, the history of the world. I mean, there's been a kind of a history that we've often long looked at of what you might call concentration. That is empires. You know, you can go back an awful long way. I don't mean even going back into the dawn of history, but I mean you can go back into the European burst out into the world ever since, you know, say the 14th or 15th century. There have been a series of empires, or imperial states, great powers, fighting each other. Sometimes there were a few of them, sometimes there were more than a few, sometimes there were quite a number of them. Over time, they've lessened until in the period after World War II, you had two, and they weren't great powers anymore, they were superpowers, the U.S. and the USSR. In 1990, you suddenly had one. It seemed like the ultimate moment, and this, of course, is the in essence, the psychology of the Bush administration. The story seemed obvious. There's only one power on Earth. All power is concentrated in it. It's got a military, which the next 10, 12, or 14 countries can't match and put together in terms of investment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, so that's one story, and it's the story you were kind of mentioning there, which is the unipolar world. But there's another story lurking under it, and it's a story of fragmentation. I understand it less, but I see it there. And that is everywhere that unipolar power, you know, the last superpower, the hyperpower, whatever you want to call the United States, and what we were called for a long time, but nobody says that anymore. Who says the lone superpower anymore? I don't think anybody. That was pretty popular for a while. Every time since 9/11, it's moved out into the world. You can mention it, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. I mean, you can run through these instances. Each one resulted not in the ability to exercise that unipolar power in a striking way, but in a kind of chaos, destabilization of regions, military frustration, and, in fact, in some cases, defeat. I mean, it's rather striking, and we remain a world in which we are still the unipolar power. I mean, that is, nobody is rising really to challenge us. I think it would be a more complicated discussion, but I don't think China is that power. It is rising. It's economically rising and in its region. But that, for whatever reason, that unipolar force seems not very applicable to the world. Something else is going on, Gary. So my answer is, I'm not sure where we're heading, but I don't think we're just heading for a one global, you know, for the U.S. uber Alice, you know, controlling the world. I mean, our ability to control anything has actually shrunk. And at the same time, you know, our country is beginning to have just a little bit of a third worldish edge to it. I mean, that is, the infrastructure is collapsing. Money, we know where money's going, and it's not going into this country. So I think there's a complicated story here. I don't completely understand it, but that would be okay. my provisional answer.
We're going to depart from this in a little different direction to address quickly a couple of the thoughts you just shared with us.
Sure.
There's right now 18 million children who go to bed food insecure. They don't get enough food in a day to eat.
Yeah.
We have 1.6 million children who leave school each day and don't have a home to go to. There's currently 4.5 million Americans living on less than $2 a day. When you mention China, I don't believe that the American public realizes that China and Russia and other countries like Brazil, India, and now 22 Central and South American countries wanting to join the BRIC group and are going to not look at it militarily. There's no advantage in any of these major powers having a military adventure anywhere, but they're also smart enough to see that Americans are so hell-bent on showing military dominance of a problem that they're forgetting about the economy.
Yeah.
Just today, Europe and China start direct trading in euros and yuan as de-dollarization expands. This is from Bloomberg, quote, China will start direct trading between the yuan and the euro tomorrow as the world's second largest economy seeks to spur global use of its currency. And it turns out that they're not alone. it also says, quote from Bloomberg, China's trade with European Union nations grew 12% to over $404 billion in the first 8 months of this year. France and Germany companies are leading among countries outside of Greater China in the use of the yuan. So what they're doing is a very quiet but very obvious trend of trading in currencies, backing their currency with gold, both Russia with the ruble and the yuan are, until the point where a substantial part of the world can go off the dollar as a reserve currency. The day that happens, you'll see another crash in the United States. So we cannot, as you said, we cannot say that there is just one power because we haven't looked at economic power.
Yeah.
Also, when it comes to our national security apparatuses, and the reason they say they must check, double check, triple check, redundancy check every phone call. First they lied. They said that they were only capturing the numbers we called. Then it was found out that they listened to, they have the actual phone calls, they actually have photographs, everything. Here's the latest from Patrick Coburn from Counterpunch just today.
I'm
just going to share one paragraph. This is about ISIS at the gates of Baghdad, why airstrikes are failing. Here's what he says, quote, in June, the Iraq government forces nominally numbered 60,000 in army, federal police, and local police, and in Mosul, right?
Yeah.
We were never told that. We were told a far lower number. Now, and that's why there was only a couple thousand of the ISIS troops that overtook it. Here's what he says. But only one-third were actually on duty. A common source of additional income for officers is for soldiers to kick back half their salaries to their officers in return for staying home and doing another job. So, and that's true across all. Quote, a World Bank report just published reveals that 8,206 guards employed by one ministry, only 603 were actually working. And then it goes on to talk about how the army, in all sections of its entire military, it's paying all the top people in the government kickbacks so that they make a salary, they give half back to the officers, and then those are kickbacked upstairs, part of that, to the heads of agencies. Now, our government would have had to have known all this based upon monitoring not just terrorist lines, but all lines, and certainly all those lines of the government officials. So we've known that tens of billions of dollars was being squandered in Iraq. We've known that they were not capable of defending themselves. We know that with all the claiming to the public that we had to stay longer to make sure they were able to help themselves, that was all ruse. So this is where the argument falls back against them. You say that you need all this money and all this power in order to monitor. Well, here are millions of people talking on the phone about kickbacks and not showing up for battle.
Let me give you another
version. None of that is discussed in the American media.
Let me give you another version of this, Gary. If you think about the present Iraq war this way, when those troops collapsed, and by the way, you know, from the history, post 9/11 history, I think it would be a reasonable thing to say that you may not want the United States to build your army for you. From the collapse of the Iraqi army that we built after we disbanded Saddam's army, and by the way, the ISIS is now run by, you know, partially by former officers of Saddam's army who met with the fellow, the caliph, in an American military prison. So after that, when the Iraq army collapsed in Mosul and three other northern cities, I mean, half the Iraq army basically dissolved. They left behind all their weaponry. So the bombing that we're now doing, if you read it, they always say, you know, destroyed two armored vehicles and so on. We're destroying our own equipment. Our bombing campaign is basically against our own equipment, which ISIS has taken and is using, and we are now resupplying what's left of the Iraqi army, which we're now going to retrain, although we know perfectly well what the Iraqi army is going to do. So it's a ridiculous closed system of failure.
You are right about that. I want to leave today's show with just two quick comments. One, this is from Common Dreams Today. Congress cuts $8.7 billion for food stamps, but finds $22 billion to fight ISIS. And finally, Tom, this is from a hearing. This is what one legislator had to say about we the people should have information and insight. You had mentioned 92 million documents that were made secret. Here was her response.
You don't have a right to know everything in a separation of powers government, my friend. That is the difference.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
That's their telling. She told it. You know, we should be outraged by that, but that's their feelings. Tom, thank you for all the good work you continue to do, and hopefully people will take the time to read Shadow Government and become aware of all of these behind-the-scenes characters and what it means to our future. We appreciate the time you spent with us.
So glad that you could have me on. I really appreciate it, Gary.
Tom Engelhart from, and you can reach Tom at tomdispatch.com. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow.